Well, thank you very much. Hello, everybody. Good morning. Now that I'm back in Stockholm. fast trip. I've been asked by the organizers to speak about decision-making on the subject of irradiated fuel. I don't like using the industry's terms. I think we should generally avoid using the industry's language. I don't like calling it spent fuel. Irradiated fuel is much better, or high-level radioactive waste better still. They are basically solid high-level radioactive waste. Spent fuel, of course, the industry likes because it gives the false impression that it is exhausted, used up, and, you know, it's like a spent light bulb or something which has been totally deprived of all of its energy. On the contrary, as we well know, a spent fuel bundle from a CANDU reactor, for example, which is only about the size of a a fireplace log, will give a lethal dose of radiation in 20 seconds at a distance of 1 meter, whereas a fresh fuel bundle is harmless at that distance, or even in closer contact. So I think we should avoid using these words. I also think that we should avoid using the word disposal altogether, because disposal is an undefined concept. There is no definition for disposal which makes any scientific sense. In fact, the human race has never disposed of anything. What we're really talking about is permanent storage. We're talking about management, storage. We're not talking about disposal. Now, in Canada, we have, of course, had a long history with the question of nuclear power, because we were involved in the World War II atomic bomb project. We were one of three governments, the British government, the Canadian government, and the American government, which entered into an agreement in Quebec City in Canada to work together on the development of the world's first atomic bombs. Canada was involved because we had the only viable supply of uranium to contribute to the raw material for those bombs. Britain was involved because they were the ones who actually talked the Americans into the necessity of building the bomb. And so we had this tripartite arrangement. The production of irradiated fuel in Canada began in 1945. As a matter of fact, it began exactly 1 month after the Hiroshima bombing, because we already had our first reactor built. It was a military decision made in Washington, D.C. in 1944 to build nuclear reactors in Canada for the purpose of producing plutonium for bombs, as well as for other scientific research too. And there is a plaque, a bronze plaque at Chalk River, Ontario, to that effect, saying precisely that that Canada's first atomic reactor was originally designed to produce plutonium for the bomb program. We did, in fact, in Canada, sell plutonium from our research reactors to the Americans for bombs as a way of helping to finance the very costly nuclear research program that we undertook. The first commercial nuclear power plant didn't begin operating until 1966. Of course, that was following 1953, when President Eisenhower made his famous speech about atoms for peace, which caught a lot of people by surprise, even people in the nuclear community. Some people didn't quite know what he was talking about, because up till then, all the reactors were built for the express purpose of producing plutonium, not for producing electricity or anything else. Well, radioisotopes. But the idea was, well, there's an awful lot of heat generated when you run a nuclear reactor, so can't we make use of the waste heat while we're producing plutonium? And the idea is, well, we could boil water. And what can you do with boiled water? You can turn a turbine and generate electricity. So the idea was basically cogeneration. While producing plutonium, let's use the byproduct heat to boil water and generate electricity. So our first commercial power reactor is 1966. We gave a copy of our first large-scale research reactor, not that large, it was only 24 megawatts, I believe, to India as a gift. And then we and the Americans were both apparently, or at least publicly, shocked to discover that the Indians used that reactor for exactly the same reason we used it, namely to produce plutonium for bombs. And they exploded their first bomb in 1974 using plutonium from the Canadian gift of a nuclear reactor, a research reactor, whereupon Canada said, horrors, horrors, how dare you? And India said, what do you have said about this? Is only a peaceful nuclear explosive. Russia and America have been detonating peaceful nuclear explosives. Why can't we? And in fact, in the non-proliferation treaty, in case you don't know, there is a clause specifically allowing peaceful nuclear explosives. This is right in the non-proliferation treaty. But all parties have subsequently agreed, both the nuclear weapon states and the non-nuclear weapon states, to ignore that particular part of the treaty without actually writing it out of the treaty. At any rate, my organization, the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, was formed in 1975, just 1 year after the Indian blast. But the first, and we started making noises about nuclear waste, which Canadian decision makers had no knowledge even existed. As a matter of fact, I have to tell you, much to my shame, that I graduated from the University of Toronto with a gold medal in mathematics and physics. I had a PhD by the time I founded the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. And yet, up till a few years before that time, I had no knowledge that nuclear reactors produced any nuclear waste either. I thought it was a clean, safe technology because that's what I'd always been told. And of course, if that's what you're told, then why wouldn't you be in favor of it? And a lot of people, I'm afraid, are still more or less in that position. They still believe that they're being told the truth. So when we started making noises about the high-level radioactive waste, finally the government began to respond, and the first official Canadian government recognition that there was a problem with high-level waste came in 1976 when they commissioned a report that was written in 3 months by three men with no public consultation, which was Canada's position paper on high-level radioactive waste. It was called the Hare Report, the second one on this list. The Canadian government published this in 1977. It was called the Management of Canada's Nuclear Waste. And that's when they first touted the idea of geological disposal in the Canadian Shield. The Hare Report said that this offered the best prospect for long-term storage of this high-level waste. The year before, there was the Flowers Report from Britain. Sir Brian Flowers was a nuclear physicist who had a lot of experience in both the weapons program and the civilian nuclear program of Britain. And the Flowers Report said that we are agreed that it would be morally wrong to commit the world to a large-scale nuclear fission industry unless there is a demonstrated way of disposing of this waste. So they you might say, fired a shot over the bow of the nuclear industry, saying that this is going to be a major obstacle to your further development. It became, at that point, a major public relations problem for the nuclear industry. They had to convince people, politicians and the public, that they were able to solve this problem of disposal of radioactive waste. The 1977 Canadian government report and all the publicity surrounding it led to a report coming from Ontario. The Ontario Royal Commission on Electric Power Planning in 1978 published a report called A Race Against Time, in which one of their major findings was that there should be a halt. Well, what they said is that if there is not adequate progress towards a permanent solution to the nuclear waste program, then a moratorium on nuclear reactors would be justified. And they put the deadline at 1985, of course, which is now ancient history. CCNR, I authored a report for the Canadian Coalition entitled Nuclear Waste, What, Me Worry? In 1978, which was primarily a point-by-point critique of the Hare Report, the government position paper. And that is available on our website, ccnr.org, as many of these documents, excerpts from these documents are on the website as well. There was a House of Commons inquiry in Ottawa in 1977 to 78, and they received over 300 briefs from some very surprising sources opposed to geological disposal. One of the sources that was opposed was the Canadian Geological Society. Another source that was opposed was a man named Uffin, Dean Uffin, who was the Dean of Engineering at Queen's University and Vice Chairman of Ontario Hydro. And he came out against geological disposal of radioactive waste and said, basically, well, he didn't come out against it. He said that until it is really proven there should be a cap on nuclear production. And once again, it became clear to the Canadian nuclear industry that this was going to be a major obstacle for them to expand. Now, the reason the House of Commons inquiry was aborted and never actually filed a report is because the Canadian government, in collusion with the Canadian nuclear industry, which basically they are indistinguishable, because the Canadian nuclear industry was identical to the Canadian government. It was owned by the Canadian government and run by the Canadian government. They signed an agreement in July 1978, just about a month before that committee was going to issue its report, giving a go-ahead for a 15-year research program to verify the concept of geological disposal. This research program of 15 years duration cost $700 million of taxpayers' money. It involved the establishment of an underground research laboratory about 500 meters down in a granite pluton in Manitoba. Sweden also contributed some money towards that research in order to get some feedback for their own program. Japan contributed some money. The U.S. contributed some money. But before that underground research laboratory could be built, they had to find a site. And between 1978 and 1981, Atomic Energy of Canada Limited went all over Ontario, which is a very vast province, huge areas of sparsely populated from most people's perspective. And everywhere they went, they met a wall of opposition. Municipality after municipality, region after region, after listening to AECL and listening to the critics, they very quickly forbade AECL to do any kind of research, even so much as scratching the surface, or even so much in some cases as flying over. They said, we don't want anything to do with your geological disposal research. So the massive citizen opposition in Ontario led to Atomic Energy of Canada Limited slipping across the border into Manitoba, the neighboring province, and quietly acquiring some crown land there and getting a kind of a very hush-hush deal to build the underground research laboratory there. Now, what has this got to do with decision-making? Well, all of this political turmoil led to a great deal of concern over how does one deal with these problems. And in Canada at that time, we had an old piece of legislation which has since been superseded by a much worse piece of legislation. It was called the Federal Environmental Assessment Act. And under that act, any project of this sort has to be submitted to an independent federal environmental panel review. And the panel review, although the panel members are appointed by the government, they're nevertheless generally... not all of them are independent of the nuclear industry, but the majority of them are supposed to be independent of the nuclear industry. And so the Seaborne Environmental Assessment Panel was established in 1988, and they spent 10 years conducting an environmental assessment of a concept. It was an environmental concept without a site. We jokingly called it an environmental assessment without an environment. Also, it was to some degree, you could say they were public hearings without a public because of the lack of a site. When you don't have a site, it's rather difficult to mobilize people to get concerned about this specific project. So what they were really doing was analyzing a concept. That went on for 10 years. The Seaborne Panel Report came out in 1998, and what they found was rather interesting. Let me just... I'll just sort of point out a couple of things here. I know that we don't have a lot of time. First of all, the 1978 report, this is going back to 1978, A Race Against Time. Here's their recommendation. An independent review committee should be established. An independent, now that's the phrase that's so important, that every independent body, that is non-industry body, that has looked at this problem has always recommended in Canada that there should be an independent body to adjudicate, that it should not be connected to the nuclear industry. And that's what this recommendation here is, that there should be an independent review committee to report to the Atomic Energy Control Board, and if they're not satisfied with progress by 85, a moratorium on additional nuclear power plants would be justified. Well, there never was such an independent body set up. They also said spent fuel reprocessing and advanced fuel cycles should not be part of Ontario Hydro system planning. In other words, nix on plutonium, nix on MOX. Hence, there is no need for a central interim storage facility for spent fuel. And they went further and said that we prefer on-site spent fuel storage to any centralized facility because we believe that a central facility would presuppose the reprocessing of spent fuel. The idea here being that just the cost of transporting all that waste to one site would make it very appealing to try and recover some of that cost by trying to reprocess and obtain the plutonium as a commodity. But with regard to decision-making, they had some interesting things to say. In fact, this report was the first time in Canada we really had an independent body looking at the nuclear controversy. And one of the things they said is that new and imaginative approaches to inform and involve the public in nuclear decisions, which extend well beyond the public hearing process, has to be developed. The principle of openness is important. Public participation should increasingly be recognized as an essential component of decision-making. Governments must recognize that decisions about nuclear power are fundamentally political in the widest sense of the word, and therefore in the best sense of the word. They relate to quality of life and quality of the environment. They cannot be left to the utility alone. Now, that theme is a theme that has become extremely important in Canada, and I think it's important to all of us. We have to get over this idea that scientists are some kind of gods and that scientists, by definition, are objective. Scientists are human beings, and like all human beings, they have vested interests. And conflict of interest is a well-understood concept. A judge can have a conflict of interest without being a dishonest person. A politician can have a conflict of interest without being a dishonest person. We are all subject to conflicts of interest. The nuclear industry has a very clear conflict of interest when it comes to adjudicating the suitability of any plan for handling radioactive waste, because it is obviously in their best interest economically to get approval. The reason they have to get approval is not that they're not interested in safety. Of course they're interested in safety. They are interested in protecting the environment, but they're even more interested in seeing that their industry survives and flourishes. And they would like to see that as an outcome. So there is a real conflict of interest there. Now, when the Flowers Report came out in 76, they said we agreed that it would be irresponsible and morally wrong to commit future generations to the consequences of fission power unless it has been demonstrated beyond reasonable doubt. To whom? Not to the nuclear industry, but to the people, to the population at large. The Seaborne Panel Report, moving ahead now to the end of the Environmental Assessment Review, the Seaborne Panel Report really took some interesting positions. And I must tell you that the Seaborne Panel was about seven people, and there was a real split in the panel. There were people there who were relatively pro-nuclear and also technologically oriented, and they basically were inclined to give a complete green light. There were other people who represented the United Church of Canada, who represented the non-technical community. For example, Lois Wilson, who was she was the moderator of the United Church of Canada. She's now been appointed to the Senate in Canada. She's a senator. These people, who had a less technical background, they had a different opinion. And so they came to the following conclusions. First of all, at the outset of their inquiry, they said, here's what we're looking for. This is in 1988. We need to have broad public support in order to ensure the acceptability of a concept for managing nuclear fuel waste. And safety is a key part, but only one part of acceptability. Safety must be viewed also, and this is interesting, from two complementary perspectives, technical and social. In other words, they're saying there's two kinds of safety to look at. There's technical safety and there's social safety. What does that mean? There's a whole chapter in the Seaborne Report, Chapter 5, devoted to the question of what you mean by the social dimension of safety. They also said to be considered acceptable, a concept for managing nuclear fuel waste must, and they have all these returns. Notice number D there, have the support of Aboriginal people. The reason that's there is because everybody in Canada expects that Aboriginal lands are going to be where these wastes are going to go. Talk about social justice. It's even been argued by the nuclear industry that it would be unfair to make the people in the vicinity of nuclear reactors accept these wastes, because when the reactors were built, they never agreed to accept these nuclear wastes. But it would be okay, apparently, to send them to Aboriginal lands as long as the Aboriginal leaders now agree that it would be to their economic advantage to accept those wastes. That's a very strange concept of social justice. Nevertheless, any plan in Canada has to have the support of Aboriginal people. And it has to be advanced. The last point there is a very important one for us. Be advanced by a stable and trustworthy proponent and overseen by a trustworthy regulator. Well, we haven't been able to come up with one so far, but we're still looking. In Canada, our regulator is really not trustworthy in the sense of having any independence from the industry. Now, when they finally came through with their recommendations, this is their conclusion in 1998. They said, from a technical perspective, the safety of the AECL concept has been, on balance, adequately demonstrated, but from a social perspective, it has not. In other words, if safety has two aspects, they've got 50 out of 100. And also, as it stands, the AECL concept for deep geological disposal has not been demonstrated to have broad public support. So they failed on the support criterion, and they got 50% on the safety criterion. Not a very good score. They also recommended the following. We've developed the following basic recommendations to governments with respect to a management agency. Now, these were unanimous. Although the committee was divided on some things, they were not divided on this. They were unanimous on these recommendations. That a nuclear fuel waste management agency be established quickly, and that it be at arm's length from the utilities and from Atomic Energy of Canada Limited. Of course, there's your independence. With the sole purpose of managing and coordinating the full range of activities relating to the long-term management of nuclear fuel waste. The idea of sole purpose there is that they have no other purpose. They have no purpose of selling nuclear reactors, of advancing or promoting nuclear power, of overseeing expansion of nuclear reactors or refurbishment of nuclear reactors. Their sole purpose is managing nuclear waste. That it be fully funded from a segregated fund to which only the producers and owners of nuclear fuel waste would contribute, and that its board of directors, appointed by the federal government, be representative of key stakeholders. Now, that would include Aboriginal people, obviously, as well as members of the public. That it have a strong and active advisory council representative of a wide variety of interested parties, that its purposes, responsibilities, and accountability, particularly in relation to the ownership of the waste, be clearly and explicitly spelled out. But I'd like to just conclude by saying where we're at. What's happened is the nuclear industry worldwide, and certainly in Canada, has learned that independence is poison. That if you have independent oversight, you're dead in the water, and you just can't have it. And in collusion with the Canadian government and with other governments, they have made moves to really consolidate a status which has existed for some time already, and that is that the nuclear industry operates as a state within a state, that all of the approvals processes, all the oversight and everything takes place in a kind of a hermetically sealed atmosphere, political atmosphere, which never really gets through to the elected representatives because they say, look, you don't have to worry about this stuff. We'll look after it. We'll consult the public for you. We'll do the technical studies. We'll do all the background environmental research studies. You just take it easy. We'll tell you what the public wants, and then you can decide what we should do with it. Now, what happened in Canada, you heard those recommendations. They want an independent nuclear fuel waste management. This is after 15 years of research, after 10 years of environmental assessment. What does the Canadian government do? The Canadian government sets up a nuclear waste management organization totally owned by the nuclear industry. The sole representatives on this nuclear waste management organization are the producers of the nuclear waste. They have spent, by Canadian law, there was a Canadian law passed called the Nuclear Fuel Waste Act about 5 years ago, and this law says that this agency is established by the Crown, that is the Canadian government, to advise the government as to what to do with the nuclear waste. And that this Nuclear Fuel Waste Management Organization, they should consult the Canadian population and tell the government what the Canadian population wants. And that's what has been going on. We are trying our best to overcome that fatal bias. It's sort of like, you know, if I could draw an analogy, it would be like putting the tobacco companies in charge of determining what would be an acceptable level of secondhand smoke. You know, saying that, well, they know more about tobacco than anybody else. Why don't we let them sort of, you know, do the work for us, consult the public, and then recommend to us what the public thinks, or what they say the public thinks, that should be an acceptable level of secondhand smoke. Well, that's the kind of situation we're facing with the nuclear industry. I think that worldwide we have to really make a strong effort to do two things. One is to stress the absolute importance of independence. That without independence, without independent involvement, there is no way that any decision regarding nuclear fuel waste can possibly be legitimate. We also have to, in that connection, we also have to go over the heads of the existing authorities. If those authorities are seen to be captives of the nuclear industry, we have to go to the elected representatives and say, look, you are not relieved of your responsibility. That you must have a personal responsibility. You are the elected representatives of the people. You must take responsibility for what is being done here and what is going on here, and for the accessibility to information and the freedom, the real need for independent democratic decision-making on one of the most important issues of all time. I mean, that's not an exaggeration. We're really talking about a decision that stretches beyond the horizon of any government that is in existence. That's point number one, the importance of independence. Point number two is that we have to be really clear about what box we are being put into. And the box is this. They're basically saying to us, we have the nuclear waste, whether you like it or not, whether we build more nuclear power reactors or less nuclear power reactors or shut them all down, the fact is we've got this waste, we must do something with it. So what do you suppose? What do you propose? We propose to put it underground in certain very tight containers and so on. If you don't have something better to propose, then shut up and let us get on with it. Well, I think we have to really go for an alternative proposal. And that alternative proposal is to acknowledge that we do not have the scientific knowledge to say that we have a solution to this problem. That this has to be declared openly and honestly to be an unsolved problem. And therefore, you know, once again to quote Hannes Alfvén, you cannot claim a problem is solved by simply pointing to all the efforts that have been made to solve it. We do not have a solution to this problem. That should be the starting point. And then we should have an alternative policy, and that policy should be one, I think, until we do have a solution, a genuine solution, which would be, for example, destroying the waste altogether, neutralizing the waste so they are unharmful, being able safely to transport those wastes into the heart of the sun or into the heart of the earth without any possibility of mishap. Until we have a genuine solution, we should have a policy of rolling stewardship. Rolling stewardship means that each generation accepts these wastes as a serious responsibility to manage these wastes to the best of our ability and to package these wastes in the safest way we can and to pass them on to the next generation with the expectation that they are going to do likewise and to make sure that the industry today puts up lots of money to fund this because this could go on indefinitely into the future. So it requires a great deal of contingency funds segregated from operations that cannot be touched for other purposes. And we have to really embark upon a commitment to rolling stewardship. Now, there are certain reasons to say that moving the waste underground, the older waste, I don't think it's possible to do this with the fresh waste, the new waste, the up to 10 years or 15 years. But there is some reason to think that it may be beneficial to put some of these older wastes underground just for the sake of keeping them out of the way of, you know, airplane crashes, terrorist attacks, whatever. There's nothing inherently wrong with that as long as it is retrievable and monitored. That there has to be an absolute commitment that we are not going to abandon these wastes, that we are not going to just turn our backs on them and walk away from them. Now, I do believe that this is the only responsible course of action, and I think it's necessary for us as environmentalists to settle on something that is truly positive in terms of an alternative scheme for dealing with these wastes, and that is rooted in reality, it has the added advantage that as these wastes are going to be monitored and stored, they are going to cost money, of course. That alone will make a very strong argument as well for stopping the industry and for stopping the production of these wastes. One of the reasons the industry wants to get the waste out of sight, out of mind, is so that they can have license to continue to build these reactors ad infinitum and to continue producing more and more waste, because they say, look, you don't see any, do you? It's all underground. Therefore, don't worry about it. So I do think that we have to come to grips with that. Now, if I have time, I'd like to just mention one particular mechanism that we had in Canada that I think is a model. And by the way, Sweden, when it did its referendum in 1980, I was not here, but I have heard about it, and I hear that the process was quite good. We in Canada, we had another problem, which was low-level radioactive waste, radium-contaminated waste, there weren't uranium milling waste, there were uranium refinery waste, 800,000 tons of it in Port Hope, Ontario. And they set up a siting task force whose job it was to find a home for these wastes somewhere in Ontario. It was a federal siting task force. And this is how they went about it. They said, any community in the whole of Ontario who wishes to find out more about the possibility of storing this waste in exchange for financial and other benefits, please feel free to contact us, and we will give you money whereby you can educate yourselves as to the nature of this problem, pro and con, and you can decide whether you want or not to embark upon storing these wastes. Numerous communities around Ontario applied for this program, and they actually achieved substantial amounts of funding, but this funding was not tied. They were able to hire people like myself, like Robert Del Tredici, like Norman Rubin at Energy Probe in Ontario, as well as people from the nuclear industry, to come in and educate the entire community. The net result of all this, after 3 years, was that not one community in Ontario wanted the waste. But the point is that they all had a real chance to educate themselves, not to be subjected to propaganda from the outside, but to choose what kind of education they needed as a community and to obtain it. I think that that should be a minimum requirement for public participation when it comes to any type of siting of any sort. Thank you for the opportunity of discussing decision-making in nuclear waste. And I do think that internationally, all of us people in different countries who are facing similar problems, we should really be heating up the internet wires and trying to come up with common strategies which we can use, because the industry certainly has a common strategy. And that strategy is an irresponsible one. What we need is a responsible strategy. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Gordon. We're into a question period. We're not really running out of time directly. So if anyone has questions, because I think many of us recognized ourselves, this Canadian situation is very, very similar to what we're up against, I think. Questions? Ola?
It's not actually a question. It's more a statement, because since I come from the country where we are furthest in the plans, we have the two nuclear industries, that means TVO, Teollisuuden Voima, and Fortum. Fortum has got two reactors in Loviisa, and TVO has got two reactors in Olkiluoto, which is on the west coast opposite Forsmark, and they are building the EPR reactor. And then we have two more projects coming on up from Fortum and TVO, and then we have this German E.ON coming in, buying 112 hectares of land in Loviisa and wanting to start building, they say, a very big reactor there. At the same time, we have a parliamentarian, a decision from Parliament, which was made before they voted about the fifth reactor. They voted about the waste site, and that it should be there should be a research station made up in Olkiluoto, which most likely is going to be the waste storage, and it's going to be the waste storage. Today, yesterday before I left, I read that they are now down on 250 meters, which means they will reach the 500 meters in 2 or 3 years. And they announced that in 2009 they will start digging the tunnels. They didn't even say that it has to be manifested that it is going to be the waste storage, because it's obvious. They don't even need to ask anybody. And they said that in 2020 it will be taken into use. At the same time, I read about Sweden, that you will have this Miljödomstolen, which is the uppest environmental court, and that the Miljöråd, I don't remember his name, has said that it might be that you cannot start the whole thing before 2020. That's the time when we start putting down the waste. So my conclusion is that all the efforts now in Finland are put on stopping, not the fifth because we cannot do it, but maybe the sixth and the seventh and the eighth, and maybe the uranium mining. And there is no debate whatsoever, wherever, about the waste. It's just proceeding. Not even the parliament is talking about what is going on.
Yes, hello. My name is Marika Dörwald from Friends of the Earth and Milkas. I was thinking of the situation in Sweden, and it's interesting to make comparisons, because in Sweden the nuclear waste industry has been pretending for a long time now that the problem is solved, or as good as solved. And now in later years, with a new environmental legislation, they can't just go on claiming that. They have to show something. They have to show some kind of account, what research they have made. They have to make an environmental impact assessment. So they have to arrange, there has to be a consultation process where citizens and NGOs and other interested people have a chance to have a dialogue and criticize and come in with the criticism or different. I can't find the word. Well, to express points of view, and they have to write it down in the protocol. And we find the environmental movement in Sweden finds it to be a problem that the industry is responsible for this process, that some independent actor should be responsible for this, and the industry be just one of the actors participating. And we also think it's a problem that there is too little independent research. There is much research made by the industry, and it's about the method they already decided long ago that they prefer. They don't do enough research about other methods to make a proper comparison. So how do you how much is it the same situation in different countries? Thank you.
There's certainly a lot of similarity, and I'd just like to point out that one of the very important things in the Canadian process that has now been superseded, we don't have this process anymore, but I think we have to struggle for a proper process. After all, it really has to be our government, our elected representatives, who pass the laws that represent the best interests of people. And if that's not going to happen, it's because the people don't demand it. I think the people have to demand laws that are truly responsive to the issues. Now, under the old legislation in Canada, this environmental assessment panel not only is independent, but they also have a series of hearings at the beginning just to establish the scope of the hearings that will take place. And it was through those scoping hearings that we got this social concept of safety. The idea here is that if you look at the Titanic as it was built, I think most engineers in the world would have given it an A+ and said, this is a really safe ship. And by normal engineering standards, you could say, well, yeah, it really was. It was a beautiful ship, very well built, modern. What could be better? Well, it sank on its maiden voyage and, a tremendous loss of life. That's bad for the people who were on the ship, but at least they were, you know, they were on the ship crossing the Atlantic. They're the ones who suffered the consequences. When you come to something like nuclear waste, who is going to suffer the consequences? the whole region of the planet where those wastes are located. So the social concept of safety means that something which meets normal technical criteria is not necessarily safe enough given the consequences. For instance, just take a simple question. If a geological repository does start leaking badly, and you do find serious contamination of groundwaters centuries later even, how do you go and correct the situation? You're not able to do so. So you have put yourself in a position where you have a terrible situation which is beyond human control. You cannot technologically intervene in a successful way to stop this. So things of that sort are the kind of things that involve a social concept of safety. I think that unless you draw the line and say, look, good enough, the best we can do is not necessarily good enough when you have an unsolved problem. In mathematics, my field is mathematics, we have problems which are not only unsolved, but which have been proven to be unsolvable. In other words, it has been proven that nobody will ever solve these problems because they are intrinsically unsolvable. Now, this concept is alien to most concepts of engineering, but we have to face the fact that this nuclear waste could be literally an unsolvable problem in the context in which they're trying to solve it. The context in which they're trying to solve it is to simply find a safe place to bury it forever. That may not be a possibility. So we have to draw the line and say, you can't just say the best we can do is therefore by definition good enough. Not so. If we can't really find a solution for it, we have to manage it. And that means we have to have rolling stewardship. So without that kind of a concept, I think you are at a tremendous disadvantage.
I'd like to make a few comments on the decision-making process and also mention something about thought, which I left out before. On the decision-making process, you heard me say that I was very critical of the way in which the British government has gone about its nuclear decommissioning program, particularly the way they decided to finance it. But I was also very strong and positive in support of the way in which they've gone about consulting the people on the nuclear waste management program. The really key challenge of the British government is moving from the phase of consulting about concepts to implementation. And I think that if they forget the importance of establishing public trust, which they achieved over 3 years on looking at ways of approaching decision-making, when they actually start implementing, if they start thinking they can just now implement in a technocratic fashion, my view is that they'll lose all the public support and all of the gains that they made over the last 3 years will go backwards. I mean, in Britain they're going to face a particular problem because the so-called political solution is to invite communities to offer themselves as potential communities to have waste. They're modeling themselves on the idea of Finland. The problem is they already know that those communities which are most nuclear friendly, that, for instance, around Sellafield, they also know are not geologically suitable. So they really don't have a matching up of nuclear-friendly communities and nuclear-friendly geology. And I don't think they're going to be able to solve that problem in a democratic fashion. I think they're going to have to impose a solution, which won't actually be a solution, but it'll be something they can try to convince the public is a solution. On the issue of Sweden, which I put up on my introduction, but I didn't actually mention this, I just want to flag the point up. I'd be very keen to talk to Swedish people who are interested in this subject, which is this. I think that there's an ethical argument to be made that those countries which sent their spent fuel to both France and the United Kingdom to be reprocessed should not just take back the waste products from that reprocessing, but when Britain and France come to close down the reprocessing buildings, they should take back a proportion of the contaminated waste from those buildings in proportion to the usage they've made of those plants. And I raise this because it would mean significant international transportation of radioactively contaminated materials, but it would actually fulfill the important principle, which is that you should have producer responsibility for waste products. And I think in those cases, you can't be in a position where you export the responsibility to another country and then ask their citizens to have the long-term responsibility for the management of that radioactive contamination, essentially forever. So it'd be interesting to know, for Swedish people, would they be in favour of having back, having shipped back to Sweden radioactive waste from decommissioning of our reprocessing plant at Sellafield?
Thank you. I would like to give you four brief informations. The first one is regarding transportation of waste. You have to know that the international regulation gives the authorization to have a dose rate on contact of a truck or a train of 2 millisieverts per hour. It means that if you spend half an hour on contact of this train or this truck, you will exceed the annual dose limit. So this problem, there is an incompatibility between transportation rules and health safety standards. And my organization, CRIRAD, wrote to the European Commissar on this issue, but he said he saw no problem. But this is a big issue. The second point is that in France we have many repositories, and we have one in La Hague, which is dealing with low-level and medium-level waste. It is leaking tritium underground, and the companies say they cannot secure the situation. So what about very high activity waste? The third point is regarding the situation in France for selecting a place suitable for spent fuel. The French law, more than 10 years ago, said you have to study two different places to compare. It's exactly what you explained, Gordon. But then our agency selected only one place, which is illegal. But still, it is what is happening. And the fourth thing is that for a few years, there is a big project prepared by the Codex Alimentarius, which is a subsection of the Food and Agriculture Organization, and they are trying to prepare a new regulation for the standards of food contamination on the planet that will enable a permanent contamination of the food with very high standards, like 1 becquerel per kilogram for plutonium, 10,000 becquerel per kilogram for tritium. And we launch at CRIRAD in France a petition. So if you are interested, and I hope you will be, go to our site and try to help us, and also in your countries, to organize pressure against this new regulation. Because if it goes into action, we won't be in a position to fight against the discharges of nuclear plants, because those discharges are very low compared to what will be accepted in the food. Thank you.
Yes, hello. My name is Maria Kylenstierna from Friends of the Earth and Milkas. I would thank you for an interesting discussion. It's very important that we have this. And I also, I'm also taking part in this environmental impact assessment a lot. And as Marika said, it's important that this process is getting more independent. But I want to lift here with you in an international perspective how we can make this question about the nuclear waste more on a national level, because in Sweden it's a problem that the discussion just takes part on a local level, and that's because about the industry, they have chosen sites who is close to the reactors, where people are very dependent on the work on the reactor plants to survive. And that really in Sweden makes the process, you understand. And how can we put this discussion on to a national level?
I'd just like to add one thing, that even though the Nuclear Waste Management Organization I mentioned to you is industry-owned, they did have to go through the motions of consulting people, supposedly. Now, most of these consultations were complete propaganda. But when they contacted the Aboriginal people in northern Canada, the Inuit refused to participate, and by the law, they must be consulted. They said, we are not willing to consult on your terms. If you want to consult us, you give us the money, we'll organize the consultations. And they absolutely made a hard and fast line about this. And as a result of having control over the budget, they invited Bob and I and other people to come and make presentations, which the industry was not at all in favor of. But it gave the communities, again, because they seized the resources that are rightfully theirs to educate themselves, they were able to really see with open eyes both sides of the question. And they came up with a blanket, saying that we don't want anything to do with this. And what's more, a strong recommendation that the government of Canada stop producing this waste, given the problems that it poses. So I think that what's really important here is to break through the mystique of process, the idea that because there's organizations and processes set up, that therefore you have to follow their rules. If you play by their rules, you're never going to win this game. And it's not a game. It's not a game. It's a very serious struggle for future health and welfare of our descendants and our environment. So I think that one has to realize that we have to set the rules by which we are going to participate in this. And I know what you say is very important. Anything that can be done to really make this a national debate, because this is not just a local issue, and it is totally outrageous for anybody to suggest it should be.